Okay, great. We are back for our 2011 season at the Bergino Baseball Clubhouse, and I did not know how to start off this season when I was planning the 2011 year. We just opened last June, by the way, and somebody yelled in our crowd a couple minutes ago, said, "Play ball." And there's a quote, I believe, by Willie Stargell. I could be wrong on this, but I think he said something to the effect of, "The umpire says, play ball, not work ball." And Zach is the perfect guy to start us off with a truly fun event for this year. And I'm honored that Zach is here. Zach Hampel has snagged 4,662 baseballs at 48 Major League stadiums. He's been on television with Jay Leno, Conan O'Brien, Katie Couric, and we're honored that tonight he's live at the Bergino Baseball Clubhouse in the landmark cast iron building at 67 East 11th Street in Greenwich Village. And it's a true pleasure to have you here tonight, Zach.
It's great to be here, thanks. And you forgot Rosie O'Donnell.
Ah.
you can't leave her.
She may come through the window here. All right. Although Rosie was in that movie, A League of Their Own.
There we go.
Yeah, perfect. See, everything ties in with baseball somehow. So I think that Zach's new book is called The Baseball by Anchor Books. It just came out. And I think the best way to start our discussion is really for you to just talk about, how did you get into this fascination with a baseball? How did it start?
I admit I do have a weird fixation with baseballs. It started when I was probably about 4 years old. I heard my dad and a friend just screaming with delight in a room in the house, and kind of ran in to see what was happening. And they were watching baseball on TV. And I know now that what was happening at the time was pretty special. Fernando Valenzuela had just hit a home run. Now, when you're four, you don't know why that's a big deal. But what kind of stuck in my mind was, wow, there's this thing called baseball that makes my dad so happy, so maybe it can make me happy. And as I watched games over the next few years, I would see foul balls and home runs flying to the crowd, and I'd see fans just going nuts trying to catch them. And I wanted to experience that kind of joy. I'd see the high fives, I'd see the celebrations, I'd see people throw their beers up in the air to try to catch a ball or whatever. So it had to be something cool. And when I was six, I went to my first game at Yankee Stadium with my dad, took my glove. We aimed for a first pitch arrival, took a wrong turn, got stuck in traffic, got there in the third inning, found our seats way up in the upper deck in the middle of a long row of fans. I had my glove. I was shrieking, "Hit it here, hit it here," probably annoying everybody around me. And, of course, then we had to leave in the seventh inning to beat traffic. And I, not surprisingly, did not catch a ball that day. And I went to games for six more years before I kind of stumbled upon an important clue, which was, I read in Beckett Baseball Card Monthly, they had an article kind of talking about how to maximize your trip to the stadium. And one thing it said was, attend batting practice. And it talked about how you can get baseballs and autographs and get there early as long as you have a ticket. And so I begged and pleaded my parents to take me early to Shea Stadium. And, "What? You want us to leave at what time?" And, you know, it was kind of a struggle. But when I was 12, they did finally take me to my first batting practice ever. And I got two baseballs tossed to me that day by Mets pitchers. And when you're young, or really at any age, I think, and you experience something great, you want to experience it again. And I think I just kind of have an obsessive personality by nature. So I wanted more baseballs and more. And the challenge, really, when I was 12 and 13, was really just getting to go to games. And when I was 14, I was finally given permission to take the subway to games by myself, which really wasn't that big of a deal because I'd already been riding the subway to and from school on my own for a couple of years. And that's really when my collecting took off. 1992 was my first big year. I had 18 lifetime baseballs entering that season and caught so many in the first month that I said, "Well, I'm going to catch 100 in my life," and everybody laughed at me. But by the end of the season, I changed my lifetime goal to 1,000, and then, of course, people made fun of me for that. And here I am all these years later, probably will hit number 5,000 this season. So transitioning from the sort of obsessive little kid to the writer in me that came up with this book, I just kind of realized that the baseball is just such an important artifact. There's so much culture and history surrounding it, and it's more than just a little 5-ounce sphere of cowhide and rubber and cork and yarn. It almost tells a story of America, and it certainly tells the story of baseball history. And it was fun to sort of quote-unquote intellectualize it a little bit and dig deeper. And of course, Snagging Baseballs is a big part of this new book. The final third of the book actually teaches people how to go to games and catch balls. But I certainly learned a lot, and I thought I knew everything about baseballs going into this project. But my research for this book took me to a lot of interesting places, and I'm pretty psyched with how it all turned out.
Well, your research was fantastic. I can say that reading the book, I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I thought I knew a fair amount about baseballs, given that that's what I make. but I learned a lot, which leads us into, other than Bergino baseballs, of course, probably the most famous baseball is a Rawlings. And if you have a whole chapter about the Rawlings baseball factory in Costa Rica. And I think many people are under the assumption that Major League Baseballs are made in the United States. That's not true. And if you could just tell us a little bit about what you experienced and what goes on at the Rawlings factory, I thought it was fascinating.
Absolutely, yeah. I will just point out that a lot of people, when I mention that I wrote a book about baseballs, they say, oh, like how the baseball is made and stuff. And, you know, yeah, that's one solid chapter of the book. And I also have an evolution of the ball timeline, which starts in the 1840s and goes pretty much year by year. But that doesn't even focus on just the construction of the ball. There's a lot of controversies and sort of the ebb and flow of the sport and a lot of the personalities that came into play. And there are other sections in the book that have nothing to do with the construction of balls. There's a whole chapter, for example, called Death by Baseball that talks about some players and fans and even a few unlucky birds over the years that have been killed by baseballs. There's a whole chapter called Stunts that talks about some of the wacky things that players and other people have done with baseballs, you know, guys trying to catch balls dropped off of buildings and out of airplanes. There's a chapter called Foul Balls in Pop Culture where I critique the foul ball scenes in several movies and TV shows, and it's some pretty wacky, entertaining stuff. So I just kind of wanted to let that be known, that it's not just sort of like an instruction manual on how to build your own baseball. That's not the case at all. But as far as the Rawlings factory goes, the factory is located in Turrialba, Costa Rica, way up in the hills. I mean, the roads are unmarked there, and you can forget about using a GPS device. The factory doesn't even have an official address. It's just simply known as, like, you know, behind the Rafael Camacho soccer stadium or something like that. It's pretty far out there. And it's absolutely not open to the public, and it's pretty much not even open to the media either. Somehow I was lucky enough to go there thanks to some people at Major League Baseball who knew about me and supported this project and put me in touch with the Rawlings folks. But before I went, as far as I know, the last journalist or reporter, it had been 2003 since anyone had gotten to tour the factory. And I learned some pretty incredible things. One thing that really jumps out at me is, and I wonder if we should actually kill the lights for a second just so I can show this and then I'll explain what this is all about. Now, someone, I won't name names, kicked my baseballs earlier, but hopefully some of them are still facing the right way. Can we get that light off too?
That one, okay.
What you can see here, I think you can probably see this. Some lighter colored stamping there over the Rawlings logo. This is an invisible ink stamp, and you'll notice that when the lights come back on, you won't see that. And all of these baseballs here that I brought in have a stamp on them. Every single baseball is actually stamped at the factory, and I'll explain why in a second. But I just kind of wanted to show this to you guys because this is a very lesser-known fact about baseballs. So I guess you can turn the lights back on and I'll explain what this is all about. there's all this controversy about, you know, oh, the balls are juiced, and some years they're too dead, and some years they're too lively, and it helps the pitcher versus it helps the batter. And even in recent years, this juice ball controversy has been swirling. When you actually see how these baseballs are made at the factory, if you were there, you'd say there's no way that Rawlings or anybody is manipulating these baseballs. There are four layers of string and woolen yarn inside the core of the ball. After the first layer, it's a very thick, it's like a four-ply gray woolen yarn. After the first layer, the first winding, they will weigh the balls. And it has to weigh within a 50th of an ounce. And then there are three more layers. And after each of those layers, they will re-weigh the balls. And the parameters for those three layers are within 100th of an ounce. It is so unbelievably precise what goes on in the factory. Even the cowhide cover on the outside, it has to measure within 100th of an inch thickness, between 0.046 inches and 0.056 inches, which I believe, if I'm doing my math and the numbers right, is 100th of an inch. And they will actually shave, they'll slice the cowhide like you'd slice a bagel horizontally to actually make it the right thickness. So it's incredibly precise, and they'll squash balls in a compression machine, and they'll test how many pounds of pressure it takes to actually compress the ball a quarter of an inch, and there's parameters for that. So it's so precise, and it was fascinating to see that. One of the many quality control checks is that they will stamp the balls with invisible ink. The way that works is there are 350 employees at the factory whose sole job is to stitch the baseballs by hand. Now, they have machines that do everything else, including the winding of the yarn around the core, but the actual stitching process is done by hand. And it's pretty cool to see. The way I described it in the book is, imagine you had two people kind of hovering over your shoulder, kind of peeking at what you were doing, and you were really annoyed by them, and you kind of wanted to smack them both in the face with the back of your hand. That's pretty much the motion involved in stitching a baseball. You have to put the left needle through first, the right needle, kind of pull it out, and then you tug it back almost as hard as you can. And then you have to do it 107 more times, and that's one baseball. So it takes about 14 minutes to stitch a ball, even for the most experienced employees there. And for a new recruit, someone that they're training, it'll take easily an hour to stitch a baseball, and that ball will be so ugly looking by the time they're done that it won't ever leave the factory. They'll actually pull out the stitches and pull off the cowhide and use fresh materials to build it back up again. Every time an employee finishes stitching a ball, he or she, there's a lot of women there, will drop it in a little plastic bag sort of dangling off their workstation. And when a bunch of baseballs have accumulated, there will be a floor inspector who comes by down these long rows in between the chairs, pushing a barrel on wheels. And the inspector will give just a kind of a quick inspection to the ball, very quick, just a couple of seconds, to make sure that it's pretty much okay. Nothing major is jumping out as a flaw. And assuming it looks okay, he will take a stamp off that employee's workstation, dip it in a little invisible ink pad, and stamp it on the ball. Now, every employee has a stamp with a different serial number on it. There's 350 different numbers. And all the employees' baseballs get tossed into the same barrel. Barrel gets wheeled into another room where the more serious inspection takes place. And there are a couple guys, they dump all the balls on a table covered with a drop cloth with nice wooden edges to prevent the balls from rolling off. And they will inspect the balls much more carefully. They're looking for six specific flaws at that point, which are all correctable. One example would be a misaligned stitch. If you look at a ball, all the stitches are perfect little V shapes that meet in the middle. But if there were two stitches that didn't quite meet, they would make a note of that. Or, for example, the cowhide cover is really made with two figure-eight-shaped pieces that are stitched together, and you don't want to have too much space in between the seam, and you don't want them overlapping or touching too much. That would be another flaw. So they look at the balls, and if they find one of these flaws, they will then send it over to a blacklight station. They look at the ball under a blacklight. They will look for that invisible ink code. Then they'll put a little sticker right next to where the flaw appears, and they'll write the employee's code number on a post-it note in regular ink that can be read in the regular light, and they'll send that ball back to the person who stitched it and say, fix this, please. And it's important for the employees not to mess up, because they can actually earn incentives based on the number of balls they stitch. They get a base salary, which doesn't change even if they don't meet the minimum requirement. But if they do stitch more baseballs that are perfect, they can earn a little bit more money, and even in some cases get to leave early and still get paid for the whole week. So it's in everybody's best interest to make sure that the balls are perfect, and this is just one way that it's done. Now, if you're going to go catch a baseball and look at it under the black light, you actually may not see the invisible ink stamp. There's a final step in the production process where the balls are wiped with a rag and a cleaning solvent. And the purpose of that solvent is actually to remove any smudges or oils or even the wax from the red stitching thread that might have gotten onto the cowhide covers. But sometimes what will happen is that the invisible ink will get rubbed off with it. So I would say probably one out of every, I don't know, 5 or 10 baseballs might have a nice looking invisible ink stamp. So it's kind of a little cool thing that you can look for if you do buy a ball in a store even or catch one at a game. You can look for that stamp.
So now the balls that are in perfect condition that end up eventually in the hand of a major league pitcher, on the other end of the spectrum we have these squashed oranges that never leave the factory. But mm-hmm. for the balls that are not quite there for a major league pitcher, what happens to those baseballs?
Yeah, there are three different places that a baseball can end up when it leaves the factory. The very best of the best that have absolutely no flaw whatsoever will be approved for actual game use. The next step down, and it's always like if there's some cosmetic flaw on the ball, even something as simple as like if a cow gets bitten by a tick, that might leave a little imperfection in the cowhide, and you could actually see that on a baseball. So that won't affect how the ball performs in a game, but still, Major League Baseball and Rawlings want to put perfect balls into play. So if there's just like a little teeny flaw, a discoloration, a little teeny wrinkle somewhere, those balls will actually get stamped with a little practice logo at the factory, and they will be offered to teams at a slight discount. So they'll still make their way into Major League stadiums and get hit around in BP, but not during actual games. The third tier of balls, the quote-unquote worst balls to leave the factory, which are still so great that probably you or I could hardly even tell the difference, those are actually sold in retail stores. So if you go and buy a ball and you want to get it autographed, you're actually buying a ball that's slightly, ever so slightly, imperfect. But again, you probably won't even be able to tell the difference.
All right, great. Now I think we should get to the point of how to snag a Major League Baseball. It's not often that you get to meet someone who is the best at what they do in the world. And we're fortunate enough to have Zach here tonight, who is the best in the world at snagging Major League balls. So why don't you take us through that process of what happens?
Well, when people hear that I've snagged over 4,000 balls, they think that's impossible, and then I tell them, well, I have caught a lot of them during batting practice, and I do get players to toss me a lot of baseballs. And then they say, oh, yeah, okay, well, that's cheap. And then I say, well, I did catch Barry Bonds' 724th career home run, and I did catch the last Mets home run ever hit at Shea Stadium, and I did catch 2 of the last 10 home runs ever hit at the old Yankee Stadium, and I got a Robinson Cano grand slam, and, you know, I can sort of go down the list. So I've caught plenty of historic baseballs. I've snagged 125 foul balls during live games. 3 times I've gotten 3 foul balls in a single game, and probably would have gotten more had one of those games not been rained out after 5 innings, but I'm not bitter. So one of the biggest tricks is to get there early. Every stadium in the major leagues opens at least 90 minutes before game time, and as long as you have a ticket for the game, even if it's the cheapest seat in the stadium, you are allowed to enter the ballpark when it opens. Some places open 2 hours early, some 2.5, and then there are also places where if you have a season ticket, you can get in an extra half hour beyond that. The stadium is much emptier during batting practice. The players are more laid back. They're just hitting baseball after baseball. They're playing catch. There are fewer fans. Security is laid back. It's just a much cooler atmosphere. And you can usually go into most seating areas, no matter where your assigned seat is. Of course, I play the percentages, and you know that right-handed batters will pull most of their home runs to left field, and then during games, most foul balls occur as a result of the batter swinging late. So righties will hit most of their foul balls to the first base side and pull their home runs to left field. So if a manager, if there are two lefties pitching, for example, you know that the managers will want to stack their lineups with righties. So you sort of want to aim for one of those two places. You can buy your ticket ahead of time based on the pitching matchup, or, you know, just kind of sneak around maybe and do what you need to do if there's some empty seats somewhere, if you can, you know, sweet-talk the ushers. But I think one of the most fun ways of catching balls is actually to get them thrown by the players. It's not the most challenging from an athletic standpoint, but I love the interactive component of it, because I always feel connected to the player that tosses me a ball. And I've developed some kind of fun tricks over the years. For example, I noticed 20 years ago or so that players love to spot their fans on the road and hook up those fans with baseballs. So I now own a hat and a t-shirt of all 30 major league teams, and I always dress up as a quote-unquote fan of the visitors, and I get a lot of balls tossed to me just for that reason alone. Players love to toss baseballs to little kids and to pretty women, and of course, since I am neither, I have to be extra creative. And I do give away a lot of baseballs to kids, but, you know, I also like to keep some for myself, so... even if I'm dressing up in a ridiculous outfit and getting a ball thrown to me over some little kid, I may just turn around and hand that kid the ball. So don't yell at me. Another thing that I've done is I noticed that foreign players will respond a lot better if you ask them for a baseball in their native language. So in Spanish, I would just say, dame la bola, por favor. And, of course, Japanese is a big one. Choto, bo oro nagete kudasai. And it goes from there. I mean, I've gotten probably easily a couple hundred players who are Spanish-speaking to toss me baseballs, a few dozen in Japanese. I've used Korean a handful of times, French once for a coach on the Montreal Expos. Lancez-moi la balle, s'il vous plaît. And this one won't really work on the podcast, but I even used sign language a few times for a guy named Curtis Pride, who is 95% hearing impaired and was in baseball for quite a while. So this just sort of goes to show that you can really kind of scheme and strategize and do a lot of fun stuff with it. I also visit the team's website before I go to the games and print up their rosters. So I'll have a list of all the uniform numbers and the corresponding names so I can kind of peek at my cheat sheet. Oh, yeah, 47. And then shout the guy's name. What's that? How did I get Curtis Pride's attention? I worked at a school for deaf kids for 3 months after I graduated from high school, so that's why I picked up some sign language. And I realized that the best way, really the appropriate way to get a deaf person's attention is to just wave your arms, because if you tap them on the shoulder, it can really take them by surprise. And I even know a guy who was working at the school, just quick side note, who was shaving in the shower and someone wanted to get his attention and flip the lights, and he was so startled that he cut himself. So you don't want to do anything that will really, you know, frighten someone. So with Curtis Pride, I was just, you know, waving like this, and everyone else was shouting his name because they didn't know that he couldn't hear them. And so he looked up, and I knew that I just had a split second, and I said, give me the ball, please. That's what it looks like. And he actually tossed me a couple over the years, and he had a huge grin on his face at the time, and I felt great and he felt great. And it's just really nice to have that connection, if only for a split second, with a big league baseball player.
Well, now I know that it takes a smart guy to get 4,662 baseballs. No wonder I haven't gotten one yet.
I'm impressed that you're getting the number right. People mess it up all the time. I would have accepted over 4,600, 4,000, or just a lot.
It's embedded. It's embedded at this point.
Okay.
So you actually now have a business, a company, I guess, Watch with Zach. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
I do. And actually, there is actually a former Watch with Zach client with us here tonight.
Oh, yeah.
Do you want to identify yourself? This is my friend Cliff and his mother Gail, and they how did you guys find me anyway? Just online, you stumbled upon my blog a number of years ago.
My grandpa actually showed me your second book, I think, Watching Baseball, and I saw the little the thing on the back that said that how many balls you had collected, and then I remember you from SNY because I saw you did like an interview there, and I looked you up on the website, I saw the blog. I didn't think you'd respond, and then you responded. Because I figured, like, oh, he's not going to respond, he's not going to see this email. And then you responded the next day, and then I begged, of course.
There's always some begging involved. Yeah. You know, when it comes to kids and parents and going to baseball games, that's just like one of the laws of the universe. But, yeah, so Cliff and Gail and I went to a game in 07 at Shea Stadium, and then we actually did two more games after that. I think one time Cliff and I just went, the two of us, down to Citizens Bank Park in Philly, made a whole 12-hour day of it, and you did catch a lot of baseballs, did you not? There you go. And I even offered Cliff one of my baseballs, and he said, no, you know, your collection is much more important than mine. I want you to keep it. But yeah, I've had dozens of clients over the years, and I even did a game, as far away as San Francisco, it actually wasn't technically a game. It was the 2007 Home Run Derby. But I've done games in the New York stadiums, in Philly, Baltimore, Boston. And really the way the business started was just, there were so many people over the years that asked me, you know, hey, like, can we go to a game sometime? And I always said, no, you know, I didn't really want someone tagging along. You know, if you're sneaking past security, it's easier to do it if there's just one of you than three or four or ten. And eventually I realized, you know, maybe I can turn this into a business. So I started saying yes to people, but, you know, like, this is my business now, so I'm going to charge you. I do have a money-back guarantee. If a person doesn't go home with at least one ball, I will refund everything or just do another game with them for free. So far I have not had to refund anybody's money. I have confidence in my own baseball snagging skills. The last time I went to a game and left empty-handed was in September of 1993. So, you know, Cal Ripken Jr. may have had an impressive streak, but I'm working on one of my own, which I guess is, you know, I'm a huge nerd, but not that big of a nerd. I don't have all my stats memorized, but it's somewhere in the 600 range, 600-plus consecutive games with at least one ball. So, hopefully I'll keep that going this year, find some more clients, and I don't know if you were going to bring it up, but one cool thing that I've been doing for the last few years is using my baseball collection to raise money for charity. There's a charity called Pitch In for Baseball that provides baseball equipment to underprivileged kids all over the world. And you know how some people will run a marathon and they'll get their friends to pledge like a dollar for every mile? Well, I've kind of turned the Major League Baseball season, all 6 months of it, seven if you count the playoffs, into one big marathon. And I've been getting people to pledge money for every ball that I catch, and that money goes to Pitching for Baseball. Some folks pledge a penny per ball, and if I catch 500 balls, that's, you know, $5 contribution still helps. Some people have pledged as much as a dollar per ball, and all increments in between, and I've raised so far in the last couple years, I think about $14,000 for the charity. I have a new campaign just started fresh for this year, and it just feels great to be able to take something that started as just a dorky childhood hobby that's now become this major thing and be able to do something good and give something back at the same time, and it just adds a whole nother element to my collection. So it's not just about me, but I feel like I'm doing something good in the process. And since I pointed out that there was a Watch with Zach client in the room, can I also point out that there's someone in the room who is, if I'm getting this correct, on the board of directors for Pitching for Baseball? Arthur Pincus in the back row. So thanks for making it. And yeah, Arthur and I have gotten to know each other over the last couple years and just discuss various ways to raise money and spread the word. And again, it's just kind of one more element to what I do with all this baseball stuff.
And if somebody wants to get involved with you with Pitching for Baseball or Watch with Zach, is the best thing to go to your website?
Yeah, exactly. If you actually just search for Zach and Baseball on Google, I believe I'm the first one that pops up, but you have to spell it Z-A-C-K. Or just go to my website, zackhample.com, Z-A-C-K-H-A-M-P-L-E. And right on the homepage, I have a link to the charity, and you know, if you navigate around a little bit, you'll find the Watch with Zach stuff as well.
And to those of you listening at home who now have the Zach's website, we are here with Zach Hample, the author of The Baseball from Anchor Books. And there's you did something, I don't know when you actually wrote this part of the book, how long ago it was, but you either can see into the future or you have some very interesting stories about celebrity ball hawks, as you call them, and there's one particular celebrity that stood out above the others from an entertaining standpoint, and if you could just tell a little bit about that person.
Yeah, there have been a lot of famous people who have caught baseballs at games. I thought I'd be able to sell more copies of the book by including a photo of Justin Bieber, because he actually did catch a foul ball at a White Sox game last year. So for all you believers out there, you know, check out the book. But Jimmy Carter caught a foul ball. There have been some baseball players even who were in the stands after they retired or during the playoffs. Ricky Henderson, George Brett, and Mark McGwire all caught foul balls. Doug Flutie, the quarterback, got one. Jermaine Jackson of the Jackson 5 caught a foul ball at Dodger Stadium a couple years ago. But the one that really stands out is Charlie Sheen. And I put Sheen in the book almost more of like an honorary ball hawk, because...
It's hard to hit it on the head.
Yeah, seriously. Well, here's the thing with Sheen. Charlie Sheen really likes baseballs. I mean, you think that I really like baseballs, but Charlie Sheen at one point paid the most that anybody had ever paid for a baseball. You all remember the famous ground ball that went through Bill Buckner's legs in Game 6 of the 1986 World Series? Well, 7 years after that incident, that ball, it passed through a number of people's hands and ended up at auction. And Charlie Sheen bought that ball for over $93,000. And by the way, he outbid Keith Olbermann on that. He walked away $85,000.
Quite a pass.
But at the time, that was the most anyone had ever paid for a ball. And now, as I mentioned in the book, that ball wouldn't even crack the top 10. Todd McFarlane, the creator of Spawn Comics, paid over $3 million for Mark McGwire's 70th home run ball from 1998. That's the only ball that ever fetched more than $1 million. But there are others all the way down to, I think, number 10 is Barry Bonds' 715th home run, which passed Babe Ruth on the all-time list, and that sold for over $200,000. But getting back to Sheen, that was just sort of setting up how much he likes baseballs. In April of 1996, Sheen was so determined and so eager to try to catch a home run ball that he spent over $6,500 purchasing every seat in the left field pavilion at a game in Anaheim. He bought over 2,600 seats. Had the place to himself, and as he said, you know, he didn't want to have to crawl over the public, and he just wanted to avoid the violence. And unfortunately for Mr. Sheen, he went home empty-handed that day. So, Mr. Sheen, if you're listening, you know, we can do a Watch with Zach game together, and you'll definitely get one. And it'll cost a lot less. But there's just a lot of wacky stories like this in the book, so... I was even surprised when I started writing the book how much I had to say. My editor, Jenny Jackson, is here tonight. There. And when I first started working on it, Jenny told me, you know, you can aim for like 50,000 to 70,000 words. My last book, Watch the Baseball Smarter, was about 64,000, and I realized these numbers might not mean anything to you. And I said to Jenny, I'm like, wow, really, only 50,000? That would be enough for a book? And she said, yeah, that's enough. And I, you know, there's definitely a lazy gene in me, and sometimes it's the opposite. But my first thought was, well, if they're gonna pay me the same whether I write 50 or 70,000, then I'm gonna aim for 50,000 words, you know. Well, I ended up writing 80,000 words about the baseball just because I had so much fun with the project and there was so much to say, and there were even things that I had to leave out just because, you know, Jenny didn't want a 100,000-word manuscript. She explained that it would have taken longer to edit, it would have cost more to publish, it would have had to be marketed differently. You know, I learned a lot about publishing, too, in the process of writing these books, but there's a lot of fun stuff about the baseball, and I learned a lot and just had so much fun working on this.
Well, The Baseball by Zach Campbell, that's a tremendous 80,000 words. You really did a great job. And I'm sure there are some questions from our very big record-setting crowd, as it turns out. You set records everywhere.
Nice.
So are there any? Would anyone like to start off with a question for Zach about anything?
I can actually just give a little demo of something that I actually left out of the thing.
As long as it doesn't break anything.
Think of questions while I just show you this. I'm going to show you my famous quote-unquote glove trick. And I should have mentioned this when you asked me some strategies for catching baseballs. And I know that some people in here have seen this, if not in person, then maybe on TV. But I know that some of my real-life friends have probably never actually seen this at all. So this is cool to get to show this. There are a lot of stadiums where, I mean, pretty much every stadium will have at least one location where when you're in the front row, you're too high up to simply reach down and pick up a baseball off the field. The old Yankee Stadium was a great example. In the left and right field corners near the foul pole, the wall varied from 8 to 10 feet high. And there are other ballparks where it might be 6 feet, it might be 30 feet. After going to so many games and just drooling over so many baseballs in batting practice that would roll up to the wall and stop right below me, and there wouldn't be a player or a security guard in sight, I finally came up with a way to get these baseballs. So let me show you how this works. It starts with, I take a rubber band, and again, I apologize to the podcast listeners who can't actually see this, but
if you
search for glove trick on Google, my blog entry about this is the first thing that pops up. So you take a rubber band, you stretch it over the glove, and show of hands, how many people here have not seen this at all, ever? Nice, okay, more than half the room. So the rubber band is stretched over the tip of the glove, then I take a Sharpie, which I'll usually have on me anyway, you know, in case I can get an autograph or two, and I pretty much just place the Sharpie inside the open palm, the pocket of the glove, to prop it open. I think everyone can see this. Now, the way this works is the space between the rubber band and the tip of the glove is slightly smaller than the width of the baseball. So this trick, of course, wouldn't work if I didn't have some string tucked into the palm of my glove. Okay? And basically, you're going to see how this works now. And the challenge is making sure that the rubber band is not too tight or too loose. If it doesn't work, I just pull it up and try it again. But you won't all quite be able to see this from the angle where you're sitting. But I just try to drop the glove right over the baseball. And when I lift it up, as you can see, the ball is tucked snugly inside. And so the rubber band just basically stretches to let the ball in, and then once the ball is in the glove, right, the band kind of bends back into place and holds it there. So I don't know if you all saw that, but I'm not going to do it again. But that's how the trick works. I once got my glove confiscated by security at Yankee Stadium. I've had other guards.
Did you get it back?
I did get it back, but it made batting practice difficult to have to try to catch home runs barehanded. Other times, security guards have triumphantly, you know, snipped off the string from my glove, and as soon as they march up the stairs, I look over my shoulder, take out some extra string, and tie it back up. So I would just encourage people who are going to bring contraptions to games, be careful. You know, some stadiums are really cool, and they'll let you do it. AT&T Park in San Francisco, they will let you bring in any type of device that you can think of. Fans even bring in light bulb changers. Those are like big telescoping poles with grabbers on the end. People can bring those in. I've seen people there with frying pans with little grooves cut in with bungee cords, and they're throwing them out. San Francisco is just the coolest city on a lot of levels. And then there are other places where I have actually been threatened with arrest for trespassing and for throwing objects on the field. So you just have to be careful. And
could we ask what ballpark that was?
Oh, Philadelphia, of course.
I had a feeling.
No offense, Philly, but you know, you guys need to loosen up a little bit. And it just catching baseballs. It's just one of those things that's taken me to a lot of different cities and even some countries. Met so many people. Some of whom get angry at me when I catch too many baseballs. But just the interactions, really, and the just the randomness that has come with it along the way has just been a great, great thing. So
well, that was quite a Rube Goldberg contraption.
Yeah. Did you have a question?
I did have a question.
And is the microphone going to pick
yes,
it up?
Yes. Okay. Just speak up a little bit.
Okay, Zach. Do
yes.
you ever attend any spring training or winter sports or any of the other baseball that goes on that is not during the season in order to pump up your numbers?
No, I do not. First of all, I don't have the time or energy to be obsessed with this more than 6 or 7 months a year. Even that much is kind of draining. I've never counted balls from the minor leagues or from spring training. And it's interesting. I tell people that I've snagged more baseballs at major league stadiums than anybody ever, and that's true. There are some guys who have snagged more balls at professional games. There's a couple guys who are in the 5,000 range, but they've caught a couple thousand at spring training in the minor leagues. Now, those guys, in some cases, do not ask the players to toss them balls. So I think that what they do is cheap, and they think that what I do is cheap. Ultimately, we're friends at the end of the day, but we do like to kind of argue over who's the better ball hawk. But no, my total of 46-62 is just strictly baseballs at Major League stadiums. And I'm not going to say Major League games because there are some home run derby balls in there, but for anyone who's gone to a derby, that's probably the toughest place that you can possibly think of to catch a ball because security is insane and there's 10,000 fans waiting to get in the stadium when it opens, so you don't have the luxury of empty seats and et cetera. There's commemorative balls that people are dying to catch. So, yeah, I'm just a Major League kind of guy, and I don't follow any other sports.
I'll throw you a curveball. Everyone's talking about catching balls. Well, I've read the style of this book and the voice, and it's so delightful to read that I'm wondering who were your heroes in writing and how did you get this writing style? Because any reader who picks up this book will just feel so welcomed by your voice. So who are your inspiration and your models?
Thanks so much. I appreciate that. And good question, too. I'm kind of embarrassed to admit that I really didn't read much at all as a kid, and I never thought I would be a writer, and if you had asked me, do you want to be a writer, I would have said, hell no. I wanted to be a Major League Baseball player. I guess I don't even really know where my style came from. I mean, these days I love David Sedaris. I think he's hilarious, and his style is so easygoing and friendly and accessible, and I think that's the style that I aim for. I don't consider myself an intellectual. I mean, I had a lot of trouble in school and didn't get the best grades, and I probably got a lower SAT score than any of you. But I try not to use big words, and I just try to write as if I'm talking to someone, but I leave out all the ums and uhs, and I just try to make it fun and accessible and try to inject humor where possible, but try not to be too corny or to overdo it. My dad was really the biggest inspiration to me as a writer. He was a writer. He had over 24 children's books published, but he also wrote plays and screenplays. He wrote for television. He wrote stuff in advertising. He was also an illustrator, and he had 2 syndicated cartoon strips back in the day. And he just always told me as I was starting to work on my first book, How to Snag Major League Baseballs, and I was only 19 when I wrote that, and I hadn't even declared English as my college major. He just always told me, you know, cut the fat, like cut all the excess words out of your writing. And his own writing was very fun and friendly and loose, and I tried to emulate him, really, and just, I guess, various writing teachers over the years in college were inspirations more than actual big-time famous authors.
Zach, do you ever see yourself going to a Major League Baseball game and not going out to rap baseball? Or would it take you to be handcuffed or in a straitjacket so you wouldn't go out for a ball and just watch full 9 innings or, God forbid, extra innings without you having
that
to
would be
ball.
Torture. It would be torture.
Well, that's exactly what I want.
Okay, let's face it. Baseball is a slow sport. I mean, that's why a lot of people think it's boring, why a lot of people don't get it. I mean, the reason why it's slow, the reason why it takes 20 seconds in between every pitch sometimes is because there's this incredibly elaborate cat-and-mouse game with so many strategies between the pitcher and the batter and the catcher and the manager is flashing signs from the dugout that you don't want the other team to steal. There's all this stuff going on, so that's why it's slow and it's strategic. And I love baseball, and I will watch baseball on TV all the time when I'm home, but it is slow, and sometimes I'll answer emails in between pitches or between pitching breaks. When I'm at a game, though, I can't sit still. I have a tough time sitting still in general, and I just generally feel like I need to be doing 18 things at once or my brain will rot. And I don't know, the way I see it is a lot of people think that I'm not actually a serious fan because I'm just so focused on getting baseballs that I'm not even watching the game. And, you know, there are some times, like at Camden Yards in Baltimore, that stadium has the best place in the major leagues to catch a home run ball. There's a huge standing room only section down the right field line. But the best place within that section is all the way at the back because all the fans will crowd the front so they can see the field. It's like a chest-high wall. And when I'm standing at the back, I can't even see the field. I'm actually just looking up at the sky waiting for a little white speck to emerge. And I will stand there all game or for at least half the game when lefties are at bat. And then when righties are up, I run behind home plate and go for foul balls. So I miss half the game when I go to Baltimore. And people read this on my blog, and A, they think I'm crazy, and B, it offends some people because they think that I just don't care about the sport. But I love it. I read every box score every day, even though I don't play fantasy baseball, just because I love to know what every player and every team is doing. But the way I see it is, as long as I'm at a game, I mean, as long as I'm going to a game, I might as well bring my glove and show up early if I'm free. And as long as I have my glove, I'm not just going to sit in one place. I mean, you know, I'm in fairly good athletic shape. I like to run and move around. So if the ball comes my way, I'm going to take off down the aisle for it. And I don't know. I don't anticipate not liking baseball anytime soon. So I don't. People ask me a lot, you know, are you ever going to stop or what's your goal? And I had always been shooting for a number. First it was I wanted to catch one ball, and then I wanted to catch 100 and then 1,000. And then for fun, I started comparing my baseball total to the numbers of players on the all-time hits list. So I was actually chasing Pete Rose, who had 4,256 hits, and I was leapfrogging major league players along the way. And of course, I know it's a lot harder to get a hit in a major league game than to catch a ball in the stands, but it was still just like a fun way to play with numbers. Now that I've passed Pete Rose, I don't know. I just love it, and I keep finding new ways to make it bigger and to write about it and to raise money for charity and to go to games with people. So I really don't see this ending anytime soon for me.
Heck no. That's your answer.
Yeah. Did you have a question?
I always thought of batting practice and warm-ups as the best time to capture the athleticism of a baseball player. You know, just the art of the movement. Is there a player that you enjoy at any one time watching more of at that, you know, in that period? And getting a ball from that you know, really, I don't know, excited you more than another.
Now you're talking about players that I liked watching and also players that I was
not,
glad to
not
get
necessarily
a ball from.
During the game, but right, during the warm ups. You know, you really catch their character, their personality, their athleticism.
I do love being in a stadium early, not just because I can catch baseballs, but because I just feel like there's something almost magical about a stadium and a field. I almost feel like I could just sit in an empty stadium and just look out at the field all day and not get bored of it. Even just some random youth field in a park somewhere, I just almost feel like I'm at home and where I'm meant to be when I'm at a baseball field. And I get a lot of satisfaction simply being in a stadium. And it's great to be the first fan in line and to run in. And you actually do have the place to yourself for half a minute or a minute sometimes. And you can hear the crack of the bat echo throughout the stadium. And a lot of times the groundskeepers will just cut the grass and you can actually smell that. And you can see all types of drills and exercises that the players are doing. You know, for example, when a team comes into a city for the first day, the fastest player on that visiting team will often stand at home plate and roll a baseball down the foul lines. Because every field is tailored slightly differently, and the slope of the field can differ from one city to the next. And what that player will be doing is testing to see if he bunts right just inside the foul line, is it going to curve foul or stay fair? And there's so many nuances and things like that that you can pick up just by being at a stadium early. So I love it just for that. I would say that the player that I love watching the most now, who's one of my favorite players now, is Tim Lincecum. And he really is a freak of nature. I mean, the guy is, he's like, you know, 5'10", maybe, that's generous, and they list him at 160 pounds or so, you know, maybe if he's soaking wet with rocks in his pockets. And the man can throw in the mid-90s. It just doesn't make sense. And I've heard stories about how he can do a split and he can do a backflip from a standstill and he can dunk a basketball. And, you know, he's just this little scrawny, silly-looking white guy, and it just doesn't make sense. And he is so graceful, and you can just see that in the way he'll backpedal 4 steps to catch a lazy fly ball in batting practice. It's just almost ballet watching him on a field. And I'm going to go with Timmy as my answer for that. Yeah. I've only been to the Hall of Fame once, and that was many years ago, so I'm due for a return visit. I work very closely with the Hall of Fame and with the research director, Tim Wiles, in particular, while working on this book. I mean, they have huge archives with just more articles and information than anybody can imagine, and they told me that I was welcome to come up there and have a look at it for free. I don't know if I would have had to pay admission to get into the museum that day or whatever, but I just figured, well, it's going to cost a lot to travel there, and I'm going to have to stay in a hotel and take notes for days or make Xeroxes. So I paid them to make copies of 2 particular files and to FedEx that to me. And it cost $300, and, you know, at first it was like, damn, that's a lot for some Xeroxes. But, I mean, I couldn't have written the timeline of the evolution of the ball without this info from the Hall of Fame. And the 2 files I got from them, one was just simply called The Ball, and the other was called Foul Balls. And they had newspaper clippings, Xeroxes of this stuff, going back to the 1860s, and just unseen, never seen before, interviews with, you know, old-time baseball players from the 19th century, and first-hand accounts of just some wacky, incredible stuff that had taken place a long, long time ago. So I worked with them pretty closely, and even there were 2 women in the photo archive department that took my requests for certain photos that I wanted. And it was like a major team effort with the Hall of Fame as far as getting the info that I needed. They were great.
But did they have any interest in having any kind of a display of your...
Oh, my...
Yeah. Your career.
No, I mean, they haven't asked. I once heard from Guinness World Records they were interested at one point. But as far as the Hall of Fame, you know, I've heard it joked that, like, oh, there should be a fan wing in the Hall of Fame and you should be in there, and that would be nice. they haven't contacted me. The Hall of Fame will always accept any piece of memorabilia that anybody wants to donate.
You send them copies of your books?
I did send the people their copies. So, you know, I could get myself into the Hall of Fame by donating some of my baseballs. And I guess my name is there now because my book is there. Actually, you know what? I found myself in a few of the articles that they Xeroxed and sent to me. So I guess I was kind of already there. But I don't know. We'll see what happens with this new book.
Actually, we'll get to your question in a minute, and anyone else who has a question. But we're closing in on the end of our podcast, so I just want to mention that to those listening at home or wherever you may be. Once again, please pick up, if you have any interest at all in baseball, The Baseball by Zach Campbell from Anchor Books. It's fantastic. Zach did a great job with the 80,000 words that are in the book. And the only other thing I would like to add is that the gentleman who talked about Zach's writing style was dead on. It's a terrific read. But you learn a lot about a person sometimes, not what's in between the lines. It's kind of what happens away from the field. And two things that you did in this book really hit me, not in between the lines. The first was your dedication to your dad. It was extremely touching. And in the acknowledgments, you went on for pages, and you thanked by name the 1,169 Major League players and coaches who have given you baseballs over the years, from A to Z. And I thought that was terrific. And I don't know how to say throw me a baseball in any language except for English, but I do know that you're a mensch. And so I would just like to thank you for coming. And unfortunately, we're going to have to say farewell to our podcast audience, and we're going to continue to have fun here at the Bergino Baseball Clubhouse.